My name is Gil Stein. I'm 61 years old. Today's February 23rd, 2017. And we're here in Chicago at the StoryCorps booth inside the Chicago Cultural Center. And my partner, who I'm interviewing today, is my brother, Seth Stein.
I'm Seth Stein. I'm 64 years old. Today is still the 23rd of February. And we are in the Chicago Cultural Center, and I'm being interviewed by my brother, Gil.
Our father and you, you're my brother, of course, but our father and you wrote a book together when our dad was dying of cancer, and I've always thought that was an amazing thing, and I wonder, can you tell us about that?
Yes. Our father was very much the college sort of intellectual. He was a professor of economics at Brown University, where he'd spent his whole career, and he'd been retired for a few years and had become a professor emeritus, that's retired professor of applied math. And sort of academia, life of the mind, intellectual activity was really what he was all about. And he transmitted that to my brother and I. And you'll hear that in this interview, that he always was interested in things. Nothing was outside of the range of his curiosity. He always wanted to know more information about anything you could think of. It was never, I'm not interested in that, I don't care about that. You name it, he was interested in it and wanted to learn about it. So when you and I followed him into sort of academic careers, and we studied different disciplines, of course I went on to become a seismologist, geophysicist, you went on to become an anthropologist, archaeologist, but he was always very interested in everything that we were doing. He was very curious. He was really very much what academia is all about at its very best. And over the years, he was interested in learning about what it was that I did. Similarly, I was interested in learning about what he did. So we eventually started to discover that we had a lot of common interests. And the biggest one, which sounds interesting but different, you'd think this was different between different disciplines, but it isn't, is that we were interested in uncertainty. How do we confront a world where we don't know what the future is going to do? And economics is about how you make financial decisions, decisions about how we run a society or a country, given that we don't know what the future holds. And I was interested in natural hazards. How do we protect society against, in particular, earthquakes, but one could say hurricanes or other natural events, given that, again, we don't know what the future is going to do? So we started talking about this over the years, and where it really came together was after the big earthquake in 2011 in Tohoku, Japan, that was much bigger and did much more damage than anybody in Japan, the Japanese scientists, who were excellent scientists, had expected. And they got it completely wrong. Hence, we had the flooding of the Fukushima nuclear power plant, the huge disaster that resulted. None of this had been correctly planned. My father was very interested in the financial crisis, how the people that thought they were the smartest people in the country, the Secretary of the Treasury, the big honchos on Wall Street, all these hedge funds, guys who had won Nobel Prizes in economics, they got it completely wrong. They were sure nothing like this could ever happen again. And then we had this terrible disaster that hurt many people all over the country and then ultimately around the world. And we got to discussing what these had in common, and we realized that there was a lot more than we might think.
So it's that search for commonalities. I remember that our dad was always asking us these kind of probing questions, and then he'd sort of synthesize your answer. So what you're saying really is, and then he'd lay it out. And most of the time he'd get it more or less right. But these conversations you were having, I'm sure everything must have changed once he became ill. So how did it happen? Like, what changed in him when he became ill that sort of the immediate background to your deciding to do this book together? How did he change as a person?
It almost changed in me more than changed in him. He was incredibly pragmatic, and he'd had cancer before. It was cured or went into remission, and it came back, and they told him, you have 2 years, basically. And he probably accepted that intellectually better than I did. And I realized that this special relationship we had between us and this exchange of ideas we had between us was something that we'd want to preserve. And as academics, the way we preserve things is we write them down. So I was, one level, I wanted to preserve this intellectually, to preserve some of his wisdom and some of his insight and some of his curiosity. And what I did not anticipate was how much this meant to him. As you told me, Gil, it really gave him something to live for. And I think there were different parts of that. One of them was he really relished the intellectual challenge. He was retired in the sense that as an economics professor, they of course get paid the most of any university types. He didn't need the money. But he stayed around Brown unpaid because he loved interacting with people and discussing ideas. And that kept him alive. It made him feel part of the world. He didn't need the formal classroom teaching. What he wanted was that interaction with lots of people. And that was important to him. For me, what turned out to be very important was that when someone has a serious illness, and I suppose a terminal illness worst of all, they tend to become the disease, and you sort of view them as a disease. You think about them as cancer patients or cancer survivors. And, you know, that's pretty much all they think about. It tends to be all you talk about. It gives you a very negative sort of thing. And the future is entirely negative. You're waiting until they're going to die.
You've pigeonholed them at the right same time as this is happening.
Whereas this way, it was a whole different dynamic. We were working as two intellectual equals, discussing, exchanging ideas, working on things. And as he got frailer and so on, it didn't really matter that much. I mean, I could see it happening, and I was sad about it, but it was a whole different dynamic where he was a very bright, thoughtful, interesting guy who happened to be dying of cancer. It's a whole different story from someone who's just sort of sitting there and watching TV. And to me, that I thought was the most important thing, and I did not anticipate how much of a difference it would make, that we could have up to the last week he died. We would talk about ideas, and we would bounce things off each other. I'd say, what do you mean by that? He'd say, what do you mean by this? And it was, in a sense, it was sort of like if one is going to die, which of course we all will, and your basic view has been sort of about the life of the mind, then this was probably better than most. I mean, we didn't go into great detail about the unpleasantness and the very tough parts of his cancer. We didn't go there. I mean, occasionally we did, but I never brought that up. If he wanted to talk about it, I would, but I never started that way. This was really kind of an intellectual sort of thing. And the last conversation I had with him was about this book we were working on.
That's amazing. I did want to add one sort of complimentary part of it, which I really noticed because I, you know, obviously I was watching you guys doing this and I thought it was a beautiful thing. But in addition to our dad being such a person for whom the life of the mind was so important, what struck me is that when we were growing up, it was very hard to get his attention. He'd be up in the study working, and we never really talked about personal things much. And what struck me is once he was diagnosed with cancer, he changed, or what I saw is that he changed. I'm curious what your reaction is on this, that he really took an interest, not just in our careers. He was always interested in, oh, what kind of research are you doing? How's your career going? You know, all of that. But he really took an interest in us as individuals, as people. And when we'd talk on the phone, he would always ask about, how are you? What's going on in your life? You know, how are things? And it's strange, but I think his knowing that he was dying humanized him in a way that I'd never seen before. And I wondered, did you see anything like that? And was that feeding into it? I mean, I understand everything you're saying about how he was focusing on the work of writing the book and on asking the intellectual questions. But I think that animating all of it was this humanization almost that really happened to him. And so I feel like the way I would say what you were saying is he spent the last 2 years living and not dying.
I think that's a really good summary. I do think I put that change a little earlier. A few years earlier, my son died at the age of 21. And he and my father were very close.
He loved David.
David was very much growing up in the same tradition. And our kids picked up this too, my other child, my daughter, and your two daughters, of course, are very bright, very curious, very interested in ideas. And unfortunately, my father only really got to encounter David at the age where he was old enough to have these kind of intellectual discussions. I think he would have been delighted in my daughter. He would have been delighted with your daughters. Okay. And I think my son's death brought this home to him and started him thinking this way and started him realizing the fragility of life, that, you know, that things will come to an end. They will not go on forever. That the world is not under our control, and that stuff just happens. And he was devastated by David's death, as of course was I. And I think that set him thinking this way. And I think these two things sort of reinforced each other and made him think about things. I mean, before then, he certainly had this tendency to view everybody in very sort of intellectual terms. And this wasn't necessarily bad in the sense that it made him very non-snobbish, because he respected people for what they were. I remember he had the garage to which he took his car. He really admired the mechanic there, the owner of the garage, okay? And my father was trying to think of the highest tribute he could, and he said, well, Mr. Midas is like a professor of cars. He knows everything about cars. And as far as my father was concerned, and he was perfectly comfortable applying this sort of logic to all sorts of people from all walks of life. He wasn't impressed by their formal titles or their formal positions. You know, there were a lot of people that were big names in academia he thought were complete frauds or something. Didn't think much of college administrators, things like that. But there'd be other people he'd meet, like someone he'd meet on a golf course, that would be telling him all about something or other in his business. And that was what her father responded to. So it was very intellectual, but it was intellectual but not snobbish. As I was mentioning earlier, he became to be very good friends with Brown's hockey coach, and was fascinated by ice hockey because he was a skater. He learned a great deal from this coach and totally respected him. And it was, you know, it was that it was this was a he taught other people, like he would swim with. He respected the people he met swimming. So it's an interesting sort of thing. But I do think, starting, I would have said, with David's death, that he started to think a lot about, to much more view people as people, and to much more think about that.
Yeah, that's it's a really good point about the way David's death did. Well, it affected all of us, and I think our dad saw David in many ways as sort of carrying on this sort of set of values and this idea of trying to understand the world and the ability to hold your own in a discussion. I think that's one of the reasons he just absolutely loved David. And as you said, he was devastated by his loss. And there wasn't that long a time interval between David's death and when our dad was diagnosed with cancer.
Yes, I think
there
was a continuum. He spoke to me about the last time he was able to travel to Chicago. He came out for the Passover holiday. And there are pictures of me and him and David together.
And you all look alike.
And it looks alike. And my father commented that he really felt that David was inheriting this sort of tradition. And I think it's unfortunate, and my daughter, and perhaps yours, often said that they didn't think my father valued them, our father valued them. And I said, no, he's going to value you at the age where he can have these kinds of intellectual discussions. He can't, the other things in life I get out with my daughter and we go kayaking, and that's a big thing. My father didn't have that worldview. It was all about the life of the mind. And as the kids became old enough to participate in that, then they sort of entered into his world. He couldn't really get himself to enter their world of kids. They had to wait till they were old enough that they could have these kinds of discussions. And I mean, there were silly things like my daughter's language in one of her languages in high school was French. My father was utterly fascinated by things French, which was funny because politically he was very conservative. And he was opposed to the government doing this and the government doing that and the government helping people and the government doing daycare and et cetera, et cetera. But in France, it was wonderful. He loved France. He loved the French. As my daughter studied French and her French got better,
all of a sudden she was
all
okay.
All of a sudden, then they had something they could talk about, okay? And it would have been true with your daughters now that, they can hold their own in a sort of intellectual discussion. Mm.
Yeah, I mean it's very true our dad was someone you pretty much had to accept him on his own terms, that love him or hate him, you had to accept him on his own terms, and the challenge was always to find common ground, like something you could talk about with him. And of course, growing up, we decided very early on, don't ever talk about politics with him. And so we had to find other things. And one of the things that struck me was how much common ground you and my dad not only had just because of the relationship of being in the same family, but intellectually, even in such different fields, that you found this common ground. And I think we were talking about this before, that the title of the book, it really reflects that kind of a common perception. And can you talk a bit about the title of the book and how you came to it?
Sure. I think the thing to remember is that although he was an economist and I was a geologist, there was more common than one might have thought. And there were two. One of them is I had studied undergraduate in economics at MIT just to satisfy distribution requirements, but I understood the basic concepts. In fact, he introduced me to his friends. They were the first two Nobel Prize winners I ever met when I went up to visit MIT. And as I took some of the classes, and I could speak the language a little, not much. Second, and perhaps even more importantly, he was a very mathematically oriented economist. He understood math very well. I understand math reasonably well. Interestingly enough, the branches of math we use in physical science and the branches of math they use in social science are different, but they are common enough that we had some overlap and we could exchange things, we could relate things that way. So the book came out of basically this idea of uncertainty. It's called Playing Against Nature. And I suggested this to him once. I pointed out a famous paper that said that when we are trying to defend ourselves against earthquakes, we're playing a game of chance against nature. And the author said, it's a game whose rules we do not fully understand. And we don't choose to play this game. It's forced upon us. The author was a famous seismologist who lives in Mexico City and had the Mexican and hence was very aware of these kinds of issues. And when I used that analogy in a discussion with my father, and it turned out that this was exactly the way economists think about the world. There's actually a branch of economics, math, somewhere between them, called game theory, which talks about what should we do in an uncertain situation. And perhaps the most important thing they get across is that you try for the best you can, given that you have imperfect information, that we don't know what the world is going to do. We don't know what the stock market is going to do. So we try to make the best decisions we can in the presence of uncertainty. And that uncertainty is really important. In geology, I always describe this as we have to have humility in the face of the complexities of nature. We can say we know what the Earth is going to do, but the Earth is going to do what the Earth is going to do. And we sort of try to understand it. And sometimes we'll get it right. And sometimes we'll get it very wrong. The economists do the same thing. Many of them seem to believe they understand how the economy works. Many of them seem to believe they can control it or forecast it. The wiser ones, whatever fraction that is, realize that that's not true, that a lot of things are just going to happen. And so what we have to try to do is deal with that. And what was interesting from my father's side is that even though he was a very conservative economist, very much a believer in the free market and so on, he appreciated